Revelation, book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 6 specifically is where we left off. Remember, as we say every time, Revelation chapter 1, verse 3, it says, "Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand." That's especially important, although arguably chapters 2 and 3 are most applicable for us because they're dealing with church history ages, they're dealing with letters to seven churches, whereas the stuff discussed after that is more things that we, in my view anyways, will not be present for, but we'll be watching from the mezzanine. Some of this stuff is not real happy fun, you know, that happens on the earth. It is the Lord trying to get the attention of a Christ-rejecting world. And so, as such, we'll look at some of it. It might be a little bit of a bummer, but the truth is, well, one, it'll be a blessing because we won't be here, and two, it'll be drastic means to try to get people's attention as the time approaches towards the end. But there is a blessing from reading this. There is a blessing pronounced, so we will hold on to that. Now remember also in chapter 1, verse 19, John got what was the divine outline for the book, where he was told to write the things which thou hast seen, the things which are, and the things which shall be hereafter. The things which you have seen, chapter 1 is mainly a description of Jesus Christ that he saw. Chapters 2 and 3, the things which are, and they were the seven letters to the seven churches. And it kind of, as well as being letters to seven individual churches that existed at that time in the Turkey area, it also is, I believe, an outline of church history in many ways. And it also applies to various things going on to different churches. That's the things that are. And then he says the things which shall be hereafter. In chapter 4, starts out in saying, after this, and that word is metatauta. And at the end of chapter 4, verse 1, it says, and I will show thee things which must be hereafter. That's the same word that's used in 1:19, where it says, I will show you the things which shall be hereafter. And in chapter 4, at the beginning, boom, John is taking up into heaven. He's caught up from where he was to be in the throne room. And chapter 4 was just what he saw, as best as he could describe God on the throne, these four creatures, four-faced angel flying looking things all around the throne, the 24 elders, we talked about who they possibly were or were not, and in this worship scene going on. Then we come into chapter 5 and we see the hand, it focuses in from the one on the throne and everything going on around him to what's in the hand of the one on the throne. And it is a scroll and it's sealed with seven seals and it's written on the front and the back. And we talked about how that is a will testament. It's a title deed, I believe, to the earth, and how Jesus Christ is the kinsman redeemer, the one who would buy back the earth to get a bride, and him being able to open that scroll. And so we move from chapter 5 into chapter 6. Now, chapter 6 through chapter 19 is dealing with what is called the tribulation period. Tribulation. Now, the word tribulation, it comes from the Latin word tribulum. When they were threshing grain, we've said this before, that they would the grain is inside of little kernels of grain inside of husks sitting on a stalk, and they would thrash the grain to knock the kernels of grain out of the rest of the stuff. And the thing that they would use to thrash it, one of the things they would use would be called a tribulum, and it was a sled that would be drug across the grain to shake loose the stuff that had weight and to separate the wheat from the chaff. Well, the tribulation period is a period of time to separate the wheat from the chaff, to the shaking starts, the thrashing starts. To really understand what the tribulation is, you really have to understand Daniel chapter 9. There was a prophecy given to Daniel in Daniel chapter 9, 400, 500 years before Christ, and then some, about what was going to come in the future. Daniel is reading through the book of Jeremiah, and he realizes, because they're in captivity, Israel has been taken away to Babylon. And as he's reading through it, he's realizing, Jeremiah said it's going to be about 70 years that we're in captivity. We've been in captivity about 7 years. I better start praying. And so Daniel starts praying. He starts confessing his sin, the sins of his people. And as he is praying, Gabriel, the angel, shows up. And he gives him a prophecy. In part of that, Daniel chapter 9, verse 24, it says this. And if you want to turn there, that's great. If not, you can just listen to me read it. It says 70 weeks, or 70, literally seven, sevens, 70 sevens, are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand. Now this is an angel telling you, know this and understand it. This is not, he's not giving him something and saying, I'm going to tell you this, but you're not going to get it anyways. No, he says, I want you to know this. I want you to understand this. It says that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and rebuild Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks, or seven sevens, and 69 weeks, 69 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome times. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince shall come and destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, 1 7. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. So you read that and you think, what in the world is he talking about? Gabriel said there are 70 weeks or weeks of years, 77-year periods of years left to deal with Israel. And he says from the time when the command goes forth to rebuild Jerusalem, because Jerusalem's been destroyed, until Messiah shows up shall be 69 sevens. So there's 69 periods of 7 years shall happen from when this command goes forth until Messiah shows up on the scene. We happen to know what date that was. It was in March 14th, 445 BC. It's a matter of history when Artaxerxes Longimanus gave the command to go forth and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Now, there was a guy about 100 years ago named Sir Robert Anderson, who worked for Scotland Yard, and he decided to do some math, and he was the one who figured it all out, that if you use 360-day years, which is what the Babylonian calendar was, if you look at the way that years are described in Revelation chapter 12, some other places, it's 360-day years. So if you figure 360 days in a year, 69 sevens of years, 400, you do the math, 483 years, it works out to be 173,880 days from when that happened to when the Messiah was supposed to show up. So if you go to your calendar and you account for leap years and you go through all of the math, which is more than I would want to do, but he wrote a book called The Coming Prince where he did all of that, he came up with a day of April 6, 32 AD. And according to the prophecy that Gabriel gave, that 173,880 days, it was exactly to the day when Jesus rode in on a donkey. Now you remember before that, when Jesus had done different miracles, at times they tried to make him a king. When he fed the 5,000, they thought, this guy can give us bread, let's make him a king. And Jesus sent him away. He wouldn't allow him to do it. When people he would heal people and he'd tell people, don't tell anybody what was done. Don't let anybody know. It wasn't until the triumphal entry when he actually arranged it on a particular day. He told his disciples, go in, you're going to find a donkey, say this to the guy, he'll give you the donkey, bring it to me. And he rode into Jerusalem and allowed himself to be acknowledged as the Messiah. They were yelling, Hosanna, Hosanna, you know, blessed is you, comes in the name of the Lord. And of course the religious leaders freaked out and said, do you understand what they're doing? And he said, if they didn't, the rocks would cry out. Today is the day. That was the day that he was going to come in. This prophecy in Daniel said there would be 70 weeks to deal with Israel. Well, that's 69 of them. So there was still 1 7-year period left. But it says after the 62 weeks, after that, the Messiah would be cut off. And then there'd be this interval that happened in there. That interval so far has been going on for about 2,000 years. There's still one more 7-year period to deal with Israel. But what happened is that because Israel rejected their Messiah, it's like the prophetic clock, God's eyes went away, looked to the church, now he's building himself a bride. You remember in Luke chapter 19, Jesus, as he was speaking over the city, he said, you know, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, if only you had recognized this thy day. He basically says, you should have known today was a day. I sent an angel. He told you the dates. You've had it for 400 years. Couldn't somebody have done the math? Well, apparently they didn't. And they rejected their Messiah. So now there's this time when the Gentiles are coming in. And then we've talked about how, you know, Paul says in Romans that, you know, I wouldn't have you ignorant of this, how blindness in part has come to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles come in. Well, when that fullness is over and the rapture happens, which is what I think happens in Revelation chapter 4, then the eyes go back to Israel again. And starting at this point, Revelation becomes a very Jewish book all of a sudden. You don't see any mentions of the church anymore. The church is with Christ in heaven, and now we're looking back at the earth. And there's this 1 7-year period of time left that deals, it's the tribulation that deals with Israel. The last 3.5 of that is called the Great Tribulation, when it gets really bad. But as we're going to see, we're going to start the first half, which is the good part of the tribulation. It's not all that good, okay? It's not really that great coming. Now, so we're dealing with that 7-year period. In that whole prophecy of Daniel, he talked about this sacrifice and oblation to cease. It says, he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. Who's he talking about? What's going on here? Well, let's do this. Let's read down. Look at Revelation chapter 6, verse 1. It says, and I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals. This is on the scroll that has 7 seals. When I saw the Lamb open one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, one of the 4 beasts saying, come and see. And I saw, and behold, a white horse. And he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him. And he went forth conquering and to conquer. And when he had opened the 2nd seal, I heard the 2nd beast say, come and see. And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. And when he had opened the 3rd seal, I heard the 3rd beast say, come and see. And I beheld, and lo, a black horse. And he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the 4 beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny, and 3 measures of barley for a penny. And see that thou hurt not the oil and the wine. And when he had opened the 4th seal, I heard the voice of the 4th beast say, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. And power was given unto them over the 4th part of the earth to kill with the sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth. The 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. John is in heaven, and he sees the one on the throne. Then he sees the scroll, and he sees the Lamb who was slain, worthy to open the scroll. Well, now we come to the opening. And as he opens the first scroll, he says, behold, I saw a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and the crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. Who is the guy on the white horse? I watched The Lone Ranger. I've seen John Wayne movies. I know how this works. The good guy is on a white horse. The questionable guy, he'll ride a gray one. Black Bart, black horse. It's just the way it works. Black hat, it's very nice like that because it lays it out so that there's no confusion. You know who's good, you know who's bad. But it doesn't really work that way necessarily in real life. Who you think this rider on this horse is really going to influence how you look at the rest of the book of Revelation. I personally believe that the person on the white horse is the Antichrist, the one that's always talked about in all the movies. Jesus, in Matthew chapter 24, he talks about something that's coming. Matthew 24 is a section where the disciples come to Jesus privately and they ask him, when is going to be the sign of your coming, and you know, when shall these things come to pass, and what is the sign of your coming in the end of the age? And he gives them a dissertation about the stuff to look for. Partway through that, in verse 15 of Matthew 24, Jesus says to his disciples, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray you that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. For the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. One of the things that we know is going to happen in the tribulation is there's going to be this thing called the abomination of desolation that happens. Now, do you know what an abomination is? An abomination, a good definition, is something that makes you want to throw up. It's so gross, it just makes you want to hurl. There was, historically, an abomination of desolation that happened in 167 B.C. In 167 B.C., a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes, came in and took Jerusalem. He went into the temple of God, and he went into the holy place, and he set up an altar in the most holy place in the temple to Zeus, stood it up right in the middle. And then, if that wasn't bad enough, he took a pig, and he sacrificed it on the altar, and he splashed the blood all over the inside of Holy of Holies. Now, if you know anything about the Jews, you know that pork, bad thing, unclean animal, don't touch it. That was referred to historically as the abomination of desolation, when you took the most holy place on the earth to the most holy God and took a false god and did sacrifice to it in the middle of it. That was the abomination of desolation. Well, when Jesus said that in Matthew 24, it was a couple hundred years after that event happened. So apparently there is another event happening where there is going to be the most holy place, and there's going to be somebody go into that holy place and set up an altar to a false god in the midst of the most holy place. That person will be the Antichrist. And then the great tribulation will start halfway through. In rough figuring, the tribulation period starts, that seven-year period, when the Antichrist shows up on the scene and makes a peace treaty to bring peace to the world. Halfway through, he's going to violate that. And that peace treaty, it looks like, is going to include the rebuilding of the temple. It's going to include the setting up of temple sacrifice again. The Jews will be able to sacrifice animals, which would be good for them, because up till now, they've had a real problem, because after 70 AD, the temple was destroyed, and there was no more sacrifices allowed. Sacrifices was how they dealt with sin. They haven't been able to deal with sin for almost 2,000 years, and so they've tried to spiritualize some things away, but they really want to rebuild the temple. In fact, there is a group called the Temple Institute that is making all of the implements, all of the fixtures, all of the knives and the candlesticks and all of that stuff, so that as soon as that temple gets built, boom, they can start sacrificing again. This guy, the Antichrist, he's spoken of in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He's called the man of sin, the son of perdition. We're told that there is something restraining him when we read through that, and I won't read through 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. There is something holding him back until it says whoever it is that lets is taken out of the way and then he'll be revealed. My personal belief is it is the Holy Spirit working in the world through the church that is keeping everything from coming to a head. And then when the rapture of the church happens, there'll be no more restraining factor. You know, we're called to be salt. We're called to be light. Salt is a preservative. It's used for salting meat. It's used for cleansing wounds. In the church, Christians being here on the earth, is a restraining factor. You know, if you look around the world at the charities that are in the world, you look around the world at all the hospitals that are out there, all of the humanitarian aid things, majority of them are Christian-based. Are there some others that are secular? Yes, but by and large, when's the last time you've ever been to a Muslim hospital here in the United States that was started by Islam? You won't, because they don't. They kill people and break things. That's pretty much what they do. It's Christianity that it's the compassion and the response to the grace of Christ that causes people to go out and serve their fellow man, to be salt and to be light. Well, this guy is going to come on the scene. Okay? He's going to show up, and I really think that he is the person that is alluded to here in Revelation chapter 6, verse 2, the guy on the white horse. And I'll tell you why. This is what it says. He says, I saw and behold a white horse, and he sat on him, and he had a bow and a crown. A bow. He doesn't have a sword. You're going to see Jesus show up in Revelation 19:11, and he's on a white horse, and he's got a sword, and there's no doubt who he is. This guy has got a bow, which kind of harkens back to Nimrod in Genesis 10. And he's got a crown given to him. Jesus in Revelation 19 has a crown. It's a diadem. It's the royal crown. This guy has a different word for crown. It's Stephanos in the Greek. And Stephanos is the victor's crown. It's what they got when they competed in the Olympics and they got that little laurel wreath around their head, right? It wilted. It was a real temporary crown. I mean, you won the Olympics, you won the marathon, and they basically give you a little grass wreath to put on your head until it turns to grass, and then it's nothing. That's why Paul said, you know, these people beat their bodies and they train to obtain a corruptible crown, one that's going to rot, and we're going for an incorruptible. Well, this guy's got the corruptible crown. It's a temporary thing. He's only going to be in power for a short period of time. It was given to him. And he went forth conquering to conquer. You remember when Jesus was tempted of Satan, Satan took him up on a high mountain. He showed him all the kingdoms of the world, and he says, all of this I'll give to you because it's been given to me, and I can give it to whoever I want if you'll bow down and worship me. And Jesus didn't say, nah, it's not yours. He said, you know, get thee behind me. You're supposed to only worship God. But the fact that Satan said all of these kingdoms are mine to give means that they are his to give. And this is the guy he's going to give them to. He's going to be given a crown, and he's going forth to conquer, conquering and to conquer. And despite what the world says, he's going to be an attractive, charismatic guy. You know, I was flipping around on TV the other night, and there was one of those lame-o, lame-o apocalyptic type movies with bad acting and somebody that was supposedly the devil, you know. And he was just like all funky looking, and he was nasty, and he was mean looking, and you know, the hero would fight him and stuff, which is stupid anyways. I look at that and I think, that's just so stupid. But then I'm flipping on and I said, I'm not watching that. So I go over to PBS and they have a documentary going on about Jim Jones and the Guyana tragedy. I don't know if you remember that. Most of you guys, probably some of you guys weren't alive when that happened. I was barely alive. Happened in 1978, I think is what it was. And this guy starts a church out in California. Only starts getting weird. And pretty soon he gets real weird. And then he's got all kinds of people coming into this church, and he's starting to play mind control games with them, and he's starting to do weird things, throws away the Bible, starts claiming that he's God. Gets a bunch of them to follow him down to Guyana. Now, I had thought it was a few. They built this commune down there, great and wonderful. It actually was about 900 people, sold everything they had and went down to Guyana, set up this commune. Well, at the end of it, he talks 900 people into committing suicide, killing their children, killing their babies, drinking the Kool-Aid. He didn't trick them into it. They knew what they were doing. And the weird thing was, they had video of some of it. They had audio tapes from what he was saying when he talked them all into it. He wasn't, you know, a horn thing. In fact, he was very persuasive. We need to do this. We need to send a message. We need to lay down our life. And he talked 900 people into destroying themselves. Many of them, probably all of them, extremely misled. Only three people got away. That's the Antichrist. He's going to be smooth, he's going to be handsome, he's going to be attractive, he's going to be motivational, and he's going to talk people into doing the craziest things, and they're going to buy it hook, line, and sinker. The Antichrist, you know, we tend to think that he's going to fight fair, that he's never going to kick us when we're down, and that he's going to look like who he really is, so that we'll recognize automatically he's got horns and a dark cape, and we'll know who he is. It's not that way. This guy is coming forth. You can tell he's not Christ because the company that he has following him is bad company. Jesus doesn't keep company with these next three riders, the riders of the apocalypse. Now, one other little thing that we go through this. Remember I had said in Matthew chapter 24 where Jesus had that little confidential thing with his disciples. At the beginning of that, really parallels what we see with these various riders. Like the first guy is the Antichrist, the one who's going to come and conquer. He's going to deceive people. He's going to make a peace treaty. If you look at Matthew 24, verse 3, it says this. As he sat upon the Mount of Olives, this is Jesus, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming in the end of the world? And Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and deceive many. The first thing he said that's going to come is going to be somebody coming to deceive, claiming to be the Christ. Who's the first horse rider we see? The Antichrist. Okay? You move to the next one. Revelation 6:3. And when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast. This is the beast. It's the cherub that's flying next to the throne, the second one of them, the four-faced one, multiple wings, saying, "Come and see." And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. The second one is war. If you look at Matthew chapter 24, verse 6, it says, after he says that they'll be coming, claiming to be me and deceiving many, he says in verse 6, "And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all of these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." Now we have the second horse rider coming. All right, a couple things to note. First of all, it says in verse 4, this horse that represents wars that are going to come on the earth, it was given to him to be able to take the peace. He doesn't have to even start a war. All he has to do is just pull peace away. We'll fight ourselves. But it was given to him there, and it says again at the end of that verse, it was given unto him a great sword. You have to understand the difference between what has happened to the church up till this point and what happens here is, up till this point, there has been tribulation, there's been war, and it's always been at the hand of our enemy. When you start getting into the tribulation period, this is stuff that has been given to him by God. God is allowing this to happen. This is God's wrath being poured out as these seals are broken. And again, as it says in 1 Thessalonians 5:9, we are not appointed unto wrath, but to obtain salvation. So I do not think this is going to be happening to the church. So one of the signs of the times, one of the things that's going to characterize the tribulation period, is there going to be wars. That's where it's going to start. We'll see war starting to break out. Peace will go away. Now, our history, if you look through it as a people, it's really not all that good. It's been a lot of wars. You guys remember World War I? Well, you don't, because you're too old for that, or too young for that. But in World War I, we had approximately 15 million people died on all sides. Nasty war. I mean, we've got stuff going on in Iraq right now, and it's bad, absolutely. And one person dying in Iraq is horrible. We went to war, the thing that triggered us was when 2,000 people, 2 to 2,500, 3,000 people were killed in the World Trade Center when that happened. It was 15 million. It's a whole different scope. When you look at World War II, the numbers went to 55 million people killed. And we lost, you know, Pearl Harbor was the same thing that happened on September 11th. That was just one little battle. I mean, war is a horrible thing. And our history, all throughout the years, if you look at what happened over in Russia and in China, 20, 30, 40 million people going at a whack. Unbelievable. I mean, you just can't even comprehend. That's the 55 million people. What's Maine? A little over a million two, a million three? New York City is what, 20 million, 24 million? It's like the whole East Coast from Maine all the way down to New York City, gone. Those people just gone. That's what happened in World War II. However, where you look where the world is going today, we're continuing to spend roughly $1 trillion a year worldwide on more weapons because we don't have enough. And we're gearing up for more and more war. Right now, we have the Trident-class Ohio submarines that are out there. One Trident submarine has 24 missiles on it, nuclear missiles, among whatever other munitions they have. I work with a guy at the mill who used to be a chief of naval warfare on some different destroyers. It's really interesting to hear what goes on. But one Trident sub has 24 missiles, and each one of those missiles has 8 independently targeted warheads, nuclear warheads, that are 475 kilotons apiece. You do the math, you end up with one Trident sub has 192 nuclear warheads on it that it can shoot off. The explosive power of one Trident submarine is equal to roughly 50 times all of the munitions exploded by all of the combatants in World War II, including Hiroshima and Nagasaki. One sub is 50 times more powerful than every bullet, every bomb, everything that blew up in World War II. And one Trident sub can wipe out a continent. If a Trident sub decided to attack United States of America, it could take out the whole United States. One sub. We have 18 of them swimming around out in the ocean, waiting for an opportunity to send it off. And you think, well, you know, at least the United States has that, right? I mean, it's not our enemies. The problem is we found some other creative ways that we can make war. Forget all the biological weapons. One of the things that's out there right now, all you got tech guys know about it, it's called EMP, electromagnetic pulse. And yeah, it's in, you know, used in science fiction movies and everything, but it really is real. What they found is if you, you know, we've set off nuclear bombs, we've tested them underground, we usually drop them from a plane and they blow up above the ground. But if you set one off high enough in the air, it has a really weird effect. Let me read you a news article. This is from August in 2004. It says, what is electromagnetic pulse? It says, in addition to the ability to kill thousands of people instantly, because that's not enough, nuclear weapons have another equally crippling capability to destroy or disrupt power grids, electronic systems, and communications in an entire country, while sparing the lives of its people, at least initially. Specifically, a nuclear bomb detonated above the Earth's atmosphere would create a split-second electromagnetic pulse, similar to an extremely high-energy radio wave. For example, if a single nuke weapon detonated at an altitude of 500 kilometers could produce an EMP that would blanket the entire continental United States, potentially damaging and destroying military forces and civilian communications, power, transportation, water, food, and other infrastructure essential to modern-day society. This is the last sentence there. It says, Dr. Lowell Wood of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory described the effect of an EMP attack as instantly regressing a country dependent on 21st century technology by more than 100 years. What it does is you set off a nuke high enough in the air over a country with the right trajectory, and it shuts off all the electric equipment permanently. The cars, the phones, the TV, the radio, the planes, everything just stops. If you did one nuke at the right height over the United States, you could just send us right back to the 1800s again. And you think about what that would mean, because when all the planes and the trains and the automobiles go off, the refrigerators all go off too. In the trucks that ship all the food. I remember, you know, driving middle of the night going down to Pennsylvania and stopping at a rest area so my wife could nurse our baby outside of New York City at about 2 in the morning. And it was a just truck after truck after truck after truck, because any of those cities have at most 2-3 days worth of food. Put 24 million people in New York City and cause a permanent blackout, 6-month blackout. It's Christmas. It's free shopping day. And then it's riot day, and then it's kill everybody for their food day. I mean, the place just goes nuts. Now, the thing that I found most disturbing was this other little article I saw talking about EMP. This was from 2005 as well. It says, Washington, in the latest advance, Iran is seriously planning an unconventional preemptive nuclear strike against the United States. An Iranian military journal has publicly considered the idea of launching an EMP attack as the key to defeating the world's lone superpower. Congress was warned by this guy named Peter Pry. It says, in an article titled Electronics to Determine Fate of Future Wars, the journal explains how an EMP attack on America's electronic infrastructure caused by the detonation of a nuclear weapon high above the U.S. would bring the country to its knees. You get down a few paragraphs and it says this. As part of this thing, this guy named Peter Pry says, Pry pointed out that the Iranians have been testing mid-air detonations of their Sahab 3 medium-range missiles over the Caspian Sea. The missiles were fired from ships. So in 2005, Iran was already out in the middle of the sea practicing, not sending these things up in the air and touching them off. Gee, what would they do? I mean, it's not like we have to really think long and hard about what could happen. In one moment, the horse of war could be at our door. And that's only the first horse. That's the first thing to come. Now again, we're not appointed to wrath, we're appointed to salvation. I'm not particularly expecting all this to happen, although, you know, I'm not expecting to be here for the tribulation. But it's easy to see as these things start to pick up how quickly it all could happen. Take away a restraining force. And you think about the different terrorist attacks. Remember when that guy came over from Canada to try to blow up the Big Needle or whatever the thing is out in Seattle? Happened to get caught at the border with all the bombs and stuff in his trunk. Just did something stupid. I don't even know what he did, but that's how he got. Just happened. Well, the reason why we're still here is because we just happened to find these things. What happens when the one who is just happening to let us know no longer just happens to let us know? Things get bad in a hurry. So this is the war horse, the red horse. There's something that follows him. Now, you have to understand, too, the Bible speaks about this stuff happening like birth pangs. You know, it starts to work up. Bob, if you have any questions about birth pangs, go see Bob. His wife just had a baby a couple days ago. For her, I was at work. Bob works at the same place I do. And I get an email 11:30 in the morning saying, I got to go in. My wife's having some contractions and we're going to go get checked. That was 11:30 in the morning. Okay. And we work 45 minutes from here. I get a call from my wife at 2 o'clock. Yep, she's had the baby. And it's like, those birth pangs for her were like, that was it. I mean, and then there's the baby, happy Ian, hour and a half, you know, and all the other ladies who were pregnant saying, I hate you. I just, you know, an hour and a half, she's out the door. Well, this is going to all slowly work its way up or fast work its way up. We're not exactly sure, but we know that it's coming. And in the red horse of the apocalypse, after the Antichrist, the war is going to break out. War is going to happen all over the place. Then, it says in verse 5, and when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast or creature say, come and see, and behold, and I beheld in lo a black horse. And he that sat on him had a pair of balances. They're the scales, the measuring scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny, three measures of barley for a penny, and see that thou hurt not the oil and the wine. After war, and what always follows war, is famine. It always happens. I went to the Bread for the World site to look up some statistics today. 854 million people across the world are hungry. Every day, almost 16,000 children die from hunger-related causes. One child every 5 seconds, which means if we started at 6 o'clock, by the time we finish, 1,080 children will have starved to death in our world. This is the restrained version. This is with the Lord's restraining hand on this. What does it get like when the hand pulls away? It's almost unimaginable. You remember in the last chapter when it says John looked and no one was worthy to take the scroll and he started weeping. In fact, he was sobbing convulsively. That's what it was saying when it said weeping. It's because with nobody worthy to take the scroll, that's what continues to go on and on and on, is that kind of thing in this world. And again, it matches up with what Matthew 24 says in the next verse, in verse 7. It says, for nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines. That's the next thing to come, the lack of food. And again, you think about what would it be like if there was a major attack around the world and the seed is destroyed. One set of crops goes away. We don't have these vast grain reserves. The Mormons do. Nobody else does. Everybody else has, you know, at best maybe 1 year worth of supply. And if you take out the transportation factor, I mean, not only would people die from the war, there'd be people dying from starvation. We don't have any idea what that's like. The rest of the world, the most we see of it here in the United States, really, is what, Sally Struthers on late night TV over there? I mean, that's about it. And you flip by the station real fast because you can't bear to look at the poor kids who are starving. And with starvation, with malnutrition, comes susceptibility to disease and all kinds of bad things happening. That's also on the plate when that horse. He says, three measures of barley for a penny, or a measure of wheat for a penny. A penny, you know, you think about that. Well, a penny, what's up with that? Well, a penny is a denarius, and a penny, we're told, is a day's wage. So he's saying a measure of meal enough for one person to eat is about 1 day's wage. If you've got a family to feed, that's not all that great. If 1 day's wage feeds you and you've got five to feed, it's a bummer. And we see rationing going on. And again, we know what's going to come. We've all seen the movies with the mark of the beast and having to have a number to buy and sell. If there is rationing, if there is famine going on, it's part of the control of the Antichrist to have to go through him to get food. You know, you think of people having heard this and seen the cheesy movies and maybe even read some of the Revelation and still lining up to take the mark of the beast. Don't eat for a couple weeks. Watch your kids starving for a while and then see, am I willing to take the mark, those who are still on the earth? Do I want to do it for some God who, where is he? I don't even know if I believe in him, or do I want to get some food in my belly? Yeah, tattoo my head and give me something to eat. I mean, that's what we see going on. And then after that, it says in verse 7, and when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with the sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth. A pale horse. That's the word. It's almost like a green it's chloros. It's like the same word we get chlorophyll or chlorine from. It's just this nasty, dead, vile-looking horse. There's a guy riding him named Death, and he's trailing hell behind him. And it's not hell like Lake of Fire hell. That's English lack of words to describe it. It's actually Hades. It's the place of the dead. So here's Death in the place of the dead following him. And power was given to him over a fourth part of the earth to kill with the sword and the hunger and with death and with the beasts of the earth. 25% of the earth. In looking at this, there is something like 6.6 billion people on the planet right now. 6.6 billion. So in the not great, in tribulation light, in the first 3.5 years, 25% in verse 8 go. 1.64 billion people dead. Any of you guys watch any of the video footage after the tsunami all around like Indonesia, Jakarta, some of those places, and 250,000 people dead in just a sea of bodies lined up along the beaches in bag after bag after bag after bag of just people dead. Couldn't even sort them all out. We just got to try to get them in the ground before all the disease and the pestilence breaks out from rotting bodies. That was 225,000 spread across. Try 1.6 billion. Unbelievable what will happen in the world. The disease that will spread. It always follows when there's massive death, when there's war, when there's death, disease and pestilence breaks out to follow that. Now, again, when you look at this and you understand that we're seeing like the beginnings of birth pangs for things that are going to come, one of the things to take note of, it says a fourth part of the earth, 25%, killed with hunger and with death and with the beasts of the earth. What exactly is that talking about? Is it just saying that wild beasts are going to be tearing people up? I don't think so necessarily. I think there's a couple different ways you can look at that. It's creatures. It's something that's alive. There's all kinds of little nasty bugs out there in this world that are waiting to get you. And I'm not talking necessarily about the creeping kind, but the bacteria kind, the virus kind. Not only that, some of the diseases that we have are diseases that have jumped from animals to humans. AIDS is one they believe has. There's the whole bird flu thing lining up. You guys read about some of that. Do you know, I mentioned before about war statistics. We had the Spanish flu happened in 1918. In World War I, and I mentioned this number before, between 1914 and 1918, about 15 million people died in World War I. In 1918, and one of the things that in part I think happened to end the war, was the outbreak of the Spanish flu. It was a flu pandemic. It lasted for 2 years, in 1918 and 1920. 20% of the population of the world caught it. Somewhere between 2.5% and 5% of the population of the world died. To hold them in comparison, AIDS, in the first 25 years since AIDS was discovered, about 25 million people died in 25 years in AIDS. In the Spanish flu, 25 million people died in 25 weeks. Total, it was estimated between 50 and 100 million people died from this. And when it hit, you woke up in the morning, you didn't feel good, they buried you the next morning. 24-hour flu, and it was done. 50 to 100 million people. Well, now we have this thing called the avian bird flu. And it's a bird flu that's able to jump to humans. It's got to mutate twice. It's mutated once so that it's a bird disease, but it can jump and go to a human. What it can't do yet is it can't jump from one human to another human. That's what happened with the Spanish flu. And when that happened, everybody caught it and it just spread around the world. And you think about people traveling and everything that goes on, it takes no time for this to go around. They're planning now. They basically say it's a matter of time before it's going to happen. Bird flu is going to break out. They're already, you know, Bush has already signed the executive orders to say when it happens, there are steps we can take to lock it down. There are already plans in place to lock down entire states, guard the borders. Close when if it hits California, they seal the borders because they don't want it to spread. Because, again, when you're talking disease that kills in 24 hours and has the potential, and they already say if it hits, it's going to wipe out another 50 million people around the world. It's a fun night tonight. You guys having a good time? You guys are on. I should have brought some popcorn. I mean, I'm sorry. You know, again, this is the things that are on the horizon. And a lot of people talk about, and this is all stuff that is this is people getting what they want. Okay, these are people who have rejected Christ. They're shaking their fist at him, and he says, "I want to get your attention. You really want, because you know, you read through Psalm 2, and it says, why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing, and how they're shaking their fist at God and saying, we'll cast off his bands and we'll be in charge." This is what happens when we're in charge. The only reason it hasn't been this bad so far is because God has, in his mercy, been restraining it. But when his bride is out of here, it's going to go downhill in a real hurry. And there are a lot of people who say, well, you know, okay, so I'll miss the rapture. Big deal. I'll get right before the Antichrist comes. I don't want to be here when 25% of the planet dies. I don't want to be around here for that. Why would you take that chance? Well, I want to have fun now, and I know what it means. I mean, I have a brother-in-law who... No, it's not Todd, but I have a brother-in-law who has talked to my wife and said, I know what it means to be a Christian. If I become a Christian, there's a lot of things that I'm doing I'll have to give up. Because for me, it's an all-or-nothing thing. If it's true, it's worth doing all the way. And I'm really not ready to give those things up right now. So no, I don't want to be a Christian. Thank you for letting me know, but no, I got some stuff I want to do right now. Well, you know, you got to kind of weigh out the consequences here, and you're starting to read some of this stuff, and you think about the scary things that are going to possibly go on. Man, I'd want to be drunk every night. When you really start to think about what life is like outside of God, man, let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's what Paul said. You know, the truth is, and the question to ask yourself, we'll leave after that horse, after that seal is broken, verse 8, is, do you really know what time it is? Jesus had said, and I mentioned it earlier, he held Israel accountable for not knowing the day. They'd been given enough information to know what the day was, and they didn't. In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus is talking to the religious leaders, the Pharisees, the Sadducees. And it says this in Matthew 16, verse 2. It says, he answered and said unto them, when it's evening, you say, well, it'll be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it'll be foul weather today, for the sky is red and lowering. Oh, you hypocrites, you can discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the sign of the times. He said, you guys, you know how it goes. Jesus says, red sky in morning, sailors take warning. Red sky at night, sailors delight. Even humans are smart enough to, despite what they say on the Weather Channel, just look at the sky, look at the leaves, look at, you know, and kind of get an idea. I think it's going to rain this afternoon. I think we're going to get a storm. He says, you can tell that, but you can't look at the way the world is and know what day it is. You don't know what time it is. Paul wrote to the church in Thessalonica. Paul had been there for 3 weeks before they kicked him out of town. He went in, he started a church with people who didn't know anything. Gentile church, they weren't Jews. He taught them for 3 weeks and then they ran him out of town. He writes some letters to them, and it's interesting. One thing interesting to note, because a lot of people say, well, you don't need to bother with Revelation. You know, there's so much other stuff in the Bible. You need to get doctrine, you need to get grounded for a long time, and then we'll get into those things. You look at what Paul wrote to them about. After being there for 3 weeks, he keeps saying, you know, you remember when I was there, I told you about this, and I told you about the second coming, and I told you about the Antichrist. 3 weeks. And he's already telling these new believers who don't know anything about that. This is what he said to them in his first letter in chapter 5. This was a church that thought somebody had come in and told them that they'd missed it. They'd missed. And what do you want? They only had 3 weeks worth of teaching. They thought they'd missed, you know, Christ's return somehow. He says this to him. He says, but of the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write unto you. For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night. For when they, and again, it's important to note the tenses in this and in the subjects, for when they shall say, first he says, you know this. He says, when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child. You know, sometimes it doesn't happen when you expect it. My wife with Abby, her water broke in the middle of the night. And it happened in the middle of the night. That's when you deal with it. You don't say, you know, honey, I'm a little tired. Could you just hang on to that for a while? I got to get some sleep. A few hours. Well, you know, no, it was, we got to deal with this now. Well, you know, he said, you know that it'll come upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, that day should overtake you as a thief. You are the children of the light and the children of the day. We are not of the night nor the darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep, as others do, but let us watch and be sober. For they that sleep, sleep in the night. They that be drunk are drunken in the night. But let us, who are of the day, be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet, the hope of salvation. For God has not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation by our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him. Wherefore, comfort yourselves together and edify one another, even as also you do. I read that and I see him saying, look, you guys, You know it's coming. You know how it's going to take them, but you're not them. You know better. You've had your eyes opened up. The Holy Spirit is in you. You know that it's going to come upon them as a thief, but not you. You should know. You should be able to see what's coming on. You can read the times and the seasons. He says, we are not appointed to wrath, but unto salvation. So comfort yourselves together. Now, if he was saying, you're going to be here for the first 3.5 years, you know, but, and yeah, 25% of the people are going to die, and 25% of you are going to die horribly in plagues and wars and famines, but comfort yourselves with that it's only 25%. There's still going to be 3 out of 4 of you left. He's not saying that. He's saying, no. This is a comfort. This should be a comfort to you. You don't need to be asleep. You need to be awake because we're watching and we're being sober. In the last verse, in 1 John 3:3, it says, every man that has this hope, and it's speaking in context of the hope of Christ's return, purifies himself, even as he is pure. You know, I read through this stuff in Revelation chapter 6, and then I start reading the news, and I start reading about all of the horrible stuff that's waiting out there for us. It's really kind of a downer. I'm really thankful I don't have to be there for that. If anything, we should see that and see what's coming, and it should motivate us, one, to be ready, and two, to make sure that we're telling people that we love that don't know him that Christ is coming back, and you want to go when that train comes through the station, because if you've got to stay for the second trip, it's going to be bad. And so it should be our motivating factor. We should, if we have the hope of him returning, we should, one, clean ourselves up, and then two, be motivated out of love for our friends and our relatives to let them know time is short. You know, I know you don't want to hear it, but I love you too much to not tell you. I don't want you to feel unoffended and then go through horrible things because I didn't want to make you feel a little uncomfortable by telling you the truth. I'm not saying go out and beat people with the truth, but you got to tell them. We got to tell them. It behooves us to make sure that people know time is short. So let's pray and ask the Lord to show mercy. Father, thank you so much, Lord, that you have not appointed us to wrath, but to salvation. Lord, thank you that, God, you made a way for us to escape the wrath to come. I pray, Father, that you would continually impress upon us, Lord, the shortness of the time, that we would see the signs of the times. We'd be able to read the skies, read the political environment, and know, Lord, that the world is ripe for deception and that you're coming back quickly. And my prayer is, Lord, that you would motivate us, one, to live like we really believe it, and not spending our time being caught up in this world that is perishing, but instead, Father, help us to have your mind and your eyes and your heart towards people. And Lord, please fill us with your Spirit. Give us a boldness. Give us a passion to reach the lost, to help the hurting. And Lord, I pray you would continue to use us until you return. We pray that you would come quickly. In Jesus' name, amen.